you've said, okay, well, you know, you need to have this label of ADHD or bipolar depression or schizophrenia or clinical anxiety disorder. You know, you needed this clinical medical diagnosis to make it valid. But your story is valid. You do not need a medical diagnosis to make what you're going through valid. What you're experiencing deserves to be honored.
Hello, my betties. Welcome back to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. And today I welcome Dr. Caroline Leaf back on to the show. Dr. Leaf is a communication pathologist, an audiologist, clinical and cognitive neuroscientist with a master's and PhD in communication pathology and a BSc in logopedics, specializing in cognitive and metacognitive neuropsychology. Since the early 80s, the OG, she has researched the mind-brain connection, the nature of mental health, the formation of memory, and she was the first in her field to study how the brain can change with neuroplasticity with directed mind input. So Dr. Caroline Leaf was on the show last year, I believe, and we were talking about cleaning up your mental mess, and she's back on the show today talking about her latest book, Directed Towards Our Beautiful Children. So helping our children cleaning up their mental mess as you, if you are a parent or you are a niece or I should say an aunt or an uncle, and you have nieces or nephews, you may have seen that the struggles that our beautiful kids have today, having lived through a pandemic and the response and adults telling them, all types of adults telling them crazy things. We have a very different model for mental health today than we did maybe even 10 or 20 years ago. So we had her back on the show to talk about the difference between the brain and the mind, the difference in the way that we have cared for our patients over the last 40 or 50 years with a potentially maladaptive focus on the brain only and wanting to label everything and give it a drug rather than potentially looking at the story and the lived experience of the individual and helping them metabolize the experiences and the way that they integrate and interpret their experiences in their lives. We talk about thinking and feeling and choosing as driving dendritic brain growth. We talk about the different types. So for my nerds that are listening, you're like, oh, this is great. We talked about the different brain waves. So we talked about delta and theta and alpha and beta crests and gamma, and how all of these, when we're looking at the way that the brain operates and the way that the mind operates, how this can drive growth and learning. We talked about how we can begin to take control of catastrophizing thoughts and create an identity that serves us. So we talked a lot about identity and what identity means, kind of the scaffolding that you construct to change the our own identity in a specific way. And then we get into the neurocycle for children. So this is a model that Dr. Leaf has articulated around increasing awareness, reflection, writing, rechecking, and active reach. And we talk all about that, about teaching kids self-resilience, the importance of free play versus structured play. This is going to be a fabulous conversation. If you are a mother, a father, a caregiver, you are a teacher, you are an educator, anyone who deals with children on a regular basis, this one's for you. So without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Caroline Leaf. One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Boncharge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point, we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Boncharge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers, and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure. And that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to boncharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart. Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. you can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week. Per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there's a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's B-E-T-T-E-R. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com. Dr. Caroline Leaf, I am just tickled to welcome you back to the Better Podcast. Welcome back. Oh,
thank you. It's so great to be back with you, Stephanie. It's lovely seeing you again.
Lovely seeing you as well. And the last time that you were on here, we were talking about your original book, Cleaning Up Your Mental Mess. And now you've come out with a companion, I would say, book to the original. And this is really geared for parents and their children, which I'm very excited about because this is something that we're starting to see more and more of. We're starting to see our beautiful children struggling with how to integrate demands and stressors and what are the right coping strategies. So maybe we can just start there in terms of what you are observing in your community. Maybe moms, caregivers, dads, are you noticing an uptick in, say, maybe more depression, more anxiety, more of a poor resilience, we'll say? Is that something that you're noticing on sort of a larger scale?
For sure, on a larger scale. I don't practice clinically anymore, but I'm doing a lot of research and doing a lot of writing papers, writing books, doing conferences, and we get thousands of emails constantly and contact through social media. And this is it's a real crisis. And it's interesting because the crisis in mental health is spanning right from very young, 2, 3, and 4 year olds, all the way through to adulthood. But there's a very important but here. Mental health issues have always been around. So this is not something new. But there is something different about what's happening at the moment. And you can actually trace it, Stephanie, it's very interesting because the last 40, 50 years, there was a shift in how we manage mental health. Hmm. And keys the word manage mental health. And the way that we've managed mental health has actually made things worse. So the research is clear in showing that the shift that happened around 40, 50 years ago is part of the reason why we have this crisis today. And that is a very interesting kind of way to look at it, because the messaging that parents are getting and that everyone's getting pretty much is that there's a terrible crisis with our youth in mental health, with our children in mental health, with adults. There's an increase since COVID. There was problem, whatever. We're just hearing this all the time. Mm-hmm. And we're talking more about it, which is great, but we're not talking the way it's being managed, the way it's being talked about, the messaging that we are giving our children, the messaging that our children are growing up in and adolescents and Gen Z, the millennials, adults, all ages is wrong. And that is very concerning. So 40 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, things shifted and we became very, very focused on the brain, very neurocentric, very.
After 40 years or before, I guess my question, and I think you're about to answer it, is how did the management shift? Like 40 to 50 years ago, what was the messaging and the management? What was the change there?
Okay, so the shift that occurred was that around 40, 50 years ago, we started talking more about the mental health system as being a biomedical problem. So in other words, instead of seeing a person in life having experiences, going through stuff and having responses to those things, if you are abused in some way or if you're being bullied at school or something, those are adverse circumstances. You're going to respond with anxiety or worry or panic or stress or trauma or trauma responses and all that kind of thing. That is completely normal. So what we were doing and should still be doing is looking at the whole person in context. But 40 years ago, 50 years ago, around about there, it shifted and the whole blur between medical problems like a cardiovascular issue or diabetes or cancer or something medical that's physically wrong with the brain and the body, that that the blurring line between mental health challenges from normal life events got put into and lumped into the category of being a medical issue. So what's happened then is our life and behaviors and experiencing life became medical problems. We medicalized misery and we've literally pathologized childhood. And so the normal things that we go through in life that are challenging, that make us, that we respond to, like being bullied or going through horrible traumatic events, which unfortunately is just part of being life, part of being alive as a human, those impact us. That they will increase depression. They will make you anxious. They will make you feel, you know, experience trauma. That isn't a medical problem. So what's happening is at the moment, it's being seen as a medical problem, as a disease. The person's story is kind of being put to the side and the person's symptoms are being looked at. Now, that's what you do with a medical issue. So if someone is presenting with certain cardiovascular symptoms or symptoms of diabetes, the medical professionals will look at the symptoms, will then look for the underlying biological cause and make a diagnosis based on that. So diabetes, type 1, something's wrong with the insulin and the pancreas. So you've tracked this from the symptom to the biological cause, and then the treatment is aimed at trying to sort out the insulin problem. Totally fantastic, makes incredible sense for physical brain, physical body. But when it comes to someone, a child who's being teased consistently at school, or someone who's going through, whose parents are going through a lot of their own issues, so the child's not receiving the kind of care that they need or whatever, all the things that can happen in life, that is not a medical problem. But the child's going to show up with various behavioral and emotional and physical and perspective issues. And those are not who they are. They're showing up as signals. So if we take those, the way they're showing up as symptoms of a disease, we're then just going to say, oh, they've got ADHD. They've got anxiety issues. They've got bipolar depression because their mood's swinging. So then the assumption is that, well, they've got a chemical imbalance in their brain, or they've got something, you know, there's a genetic issue, or their brain's, there's something wrong physically in their brain. So it moves away from the child's story or the adult's story to the symptom and finding a biological cause. That works for medicine. It doesn't work for mental health. And we see that. So for 40 years, that shift has happened. And it happened, Stephanie, because people became, we learned more about the brain. So in the 80s, when I first started studying, we didn't have the MRI. We had CT scans and we had EEG, but it was only in the mid-90s. So once the mid-90s hit us and we started learning more about the brain, this seemed to become a great way of looking at people's mental health problems. And that's what's happened. So the shift moved over to, okay, well, let's look at the symptom. It's something in the brain, and the story became separated. So that's a long answer, but it's a very important answer, because the way you look at the way you and your child show up is going to determine how you actually then intervene. So you're either seeing it as, oh, there's a problem with my child as an individual in their brain. There's a disease. There's a sickness. That's very scary. And the research shows that it actually removes hope. It's disempowering, and it doesn't actually increase, or it doesn't work. It doesn't help. If yeah. that process worked, then we wouldn't be sitting with a crisis we're sitting with now. So if that model that was introduced around 40, 50 years ago was successful, the biomedical model, we would not be seeing the crisis now. We would be seeing improvements. We're not seeing improvements. Things have got worse. Does that make sense?
It does. And I so appreciate what you're saying, because I think that you often hear, certainly online, you see people talking about mental illness like it is a physical illness. And what I think you're saying, and feel free to redirect me if I'm off here, is that mental illness is not a physiological problem per se, but it is a response. And it is whether it is a maladaptive or an adaptive response to a certain set of environmental cofactors. So, you know, for example, we can use the pandemic. Like, were we all clinically depressed and, you know, did have generalized anxiety disorder for the past 2 years? Or were we having a response to having an appropriate response to a very dire circumstance? Now, certainly, I'm not saying that, people shouldn't have sought help. Of course they did. But I really like what you're saying, and what I hear you saying is that we need to really reframe some of these, you know, maybe anxiety and depression as also responses to certain environmental factors, whether that's maybe maltreatment as a child or it's the current environment or the person has never acquired appropriate adaptive strategies in order to make sense of what's happening in their environment.
Absolutely. You summarized that beautifully. And that is, you know, there's this thinking, Stephanie, that people have to have a medical label to make something valid.
Yeah.
It's wrong. So yeah. What we've done is we've said, okay, well, you know, you need to have this label of ADHD or bipolar depression or schizophrenia or clinical anxiety disorder. You know, you needed this clinical medical diagnosis to make it valid. But your story is valid. You do not need a medical diagnosis to make what you're going through valid. What you're experiencing deserves to be honored. What every single person is experiencing every day of their life is we need to be validated. It could be a little argument with a sibling, but that's relevant to you because that may make you feel so bad about yourself that you go to school that day really battling, and therefore it affects how you concentrate at school. And you know, and that may not seem huge in the scheme of all the things that can happen, but if that happens persistently and it's not addressed, that child's going to be battling to concentrate, for example, in the classroom environment. So therefore, maybe their grades start going down or the teacher notices a difference in behavior. Mm-hmm. So then suddenly the parent is called in and say, hey, listen, your child can't concentrate. Your child has ADHD. Let's go for the diagnosis labeling route. And then that limits the child. Meanwhile, the child's story is being invalidated. A child and an adult, a human, we need to be able to understand what we are going through. We need to be given the tools to be able to process and express and deal with these issues that we're going through. You can't just eliminate them. You can't eliminate anyone's story. What's happening to you and what has happened to you is always going to be there. But how we learn to manage that is going to be linked to our resilience, going to be linked to our mental health. And it's an ongoing process because life just keeps happening and good and bad things keep happening.
I'd love for you to, I think you brought up a really great point with labeling. And I've had a lot of women in my community over many years maybe complain, and this is not trying to poo-poo on teachers, we love teachers, but sometimes it's easier to label a child as difficult. It's easier to label, well, maybe they have ADHD. And if they have ADHD, maybe they'll be, maybe we can calm them down by giving them some Ritalin or whatever the appropriate, you know, prescription might be. And I think the problem, at least that I see with that, is then when we start to anchor ourselves to this identity of, well, I'm a disruptive person. I have ADHD. I would see this in clinic. I think I might have even shared this with you last time. It's not necessarily related to our cognitive identity, but I would have individuals who would talk about fibromyalgia and they would give it a possession, like my fibromyalgia. And so we start to anchor into these labels and it becomes part of our identity. And then I think it becomes exponentially more difficult to extract yourself from that identity. I am no longer my fibromyalgia, or I am no longer the disruptive child with the ADHD. So maybe I would love for you to maybe expand on that in terms of how we think about identity and how do we anchor to identity and how is that potentially playing in here with labeling, let's say, and our ability to honor our stories.
So identity, as we know, is our value and that kind of thing. But if you tell someone you are, that statement, you are, especially an authority figure to a child or an authority figure like a medical practitioner or something to a patient, there is this almost like absorption of that's who I am. And there's been a lot of research around the dangers of saying my fibromyalgia, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. because of the fact that you then get yourself stuck. So labels are very limiting. And when you limit yourself, your own value of, oh, I'm just that, and that's not good, it's broken, it affects your, you know, how you see yourself. So it feeds back into identity and it kind of just, it's very, very disruptive. And there's a lot of science around that. We saw in some of the clinical trials that we've done is that when someone is consistently labeled, like you've got this depression, you've got that. I'm thinking of one particular subject in our study that had years of childhood trauma, but like really bad, to the point where the only way that this person could cope was with their coping mechanism was suppression. And they just went through their life and went through school and went to university, and it hit them in their mid-20s. And by their sort of 30s, they were collapsing. And in that process, in their 20s, even as a teenager, they were showing up with behavioral and emotional and perspective and bodily sensational signals. They were showing up in ways that were being labeled. But the core issue was, and they were told over and over and over again, and this is a story that happens so many times, way too often, their symptoms were looked at as though they were part of this medical disease that they have, and they were told they have a chemical imbalance. Meanwhile, that research on the chemical imbalance of
yes. serotonin. Please say more on that.
I mean, it's a hypothesis that research has been done on, and the research was never ever confirming of that hypothesis. And in fact, much research has been done and evaluated showing that that is not the case. People do not have depression because of a chemical imbalance. So if someone is labeled, oh, you just have a depression because you have a clinical imbalance, that person's already feeling bad about themselves. Now you tell them that there's something wrong with their brain as well.
How scary is that? You're like, oh my God, my brain's broken.
Exactly. Yeah. And then identify that as an individual that attacks the value system. Mm-hmm. So that's on the identity labeling side. It's very limiting. And also, you know, the thing is if you label someone with a label that's not even scientific, it's unfair on the person. Around about 95% of the world's population believe that depression comes from a chemical imbalance. That's where we're sitting today. It's an absolute crime because there is a paper was released by a group of scientists last year. It had within the first few months, it had more views. It was over 20 million views than any published paper for a very long period of time. It hit all the media. Even people like CNN were talking about this article, and it was not always positive. It was like negative people criticizing, saying, oh, but that is the cause of depression.
Well, they were scared. I think people who hear that are like, but wait, how can I justify taking my Prozac? How can I justify taking my SSRI then? I've been doing it for 20 years. Doesn't that, like, have I made the wrong choice? Like that's very confronting.
Very, very scary. It's very confronting. It's very scary. And the last thing I want to do is add to someone feeling bad about themselves, because if you were to take that's not on you. If you were told by a medical professional that's what you have and that's what you need to take, who are you to question that unless you know more? And if that's the consistent public messaging, then that's all you know. And medical professionals, like 90% of those kind of prescriptions for antidepressants are given by a medical, like a doctor. They've had a three or four week rotation in the mind. They haven't had training. I've had nearly 15 years of training in mind. There's a huge difference between someone who's had 3 weeks versus nearly 15 years of training and 40 years of research in the field and 25 years of clinical experience. And that's just me. There's thousands of therapists out there and clinicians and people that have had similar training and experience. That is not the point I'm making is that to tell people that your depression is from a chemical imbalance is the wrong way around. What happens is that we experience life through our mind. Our mind is not our brain. Our mind uses our brain. Our mind is our psychological ability to think, feel, and choose. It has a whole physical component as well, electromagnetics and gravitational fields and all kinds of stuff. That combination of our ability to think, feel, and choose is put into the brain. So if you are experiencing something negative, an abuse or something, like this subject that I was talking about in one of our clinical trials, that's consistently being processed by your mind and into your brain. It's changing your brain. It also goes into your body. So every experience we have all day long is being processed by our mind into our brain and our body. So it's becoming part of three places, our mind, brain, body interaction. Now that influences how we show up as a person. How we show up as a person, as an alive human being, is a combination of mind, brain, and body. And if we have had a consistent input of negativity into us, that does change our brain and our body. Our brain is changing every moment of every day. And if it's toxic stuff coming in, like this particular subject, grew up nearly 15 years in a very, very, very toxic environment. That is 15 years of wiring into the mind-brain-body connection that is very toxic. Obviously, it's going to affect how they show up. But to just say that their reasons they're showing up with extreme depression and so on is because of a brain disease, that is unfair to, it's invalidating to what they went through. Yes, there is damage to the brain because when you have a toxic experience, it changes the wiring of the brain, which changes the immune system response, which changes the cardiovascular response, the hypothalamic pituitary response.
It's a mouthful, yeah.
Your entire body response. So we do need the medical support to deal with the impact, the result of, but that's not the cause. And it's not as simple as serotonin's imbalanced. There are a multitude of neurochemicals. And there's research, that research that I quoted that had these 20 million plus hits, they took literally every study they could find on all the different hypotheses about this serotonin or chemical imbalance. And they analyzed them. And those studies were not saying that we have a chemical imbalance. They actually did not say that at all. But that's what the public have been sold. You know, and so what does someone do if they've been on antidepressants for 20 years and they were told that they have a clinical depression? Well, you know, you fortunately our brain changes, and that's not your fault. And what we first need to do is honor the story, the reason behind. What's more important now is not to worry about the fact that you've been on antidepressants. Yes, it will change your brain. Yes, you've got to be careful of withdrawal. You can't just stop an antidepressant because your brain has changed. Extremely important that you taper off very, very slowly under
with a professional. Do not, if you're listening, do not do, if you're like, oh, that's it, I'm off it. Don't do that. These are very, very strong drugs. Definitely need to be supervised if you're thinking of tapering off.
Absolutely.
Of them.
And yeah. I actually have interviewed some of the top professionals on my podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess, and the references are all over my books and websites and everything, even the latest book on how to taper under medical professional. So you can't just stop because you can get suicidal and all kinds of things can happen. So that's one side. If you make the decision, make sure you get medical professional advice and that you understand the process. Don't go to someone who doesn't know what they're doing. There's a lot of people out there that do know how to guide withdrawal, and there are withdrawal symptoms. So that's very important. The other side is you need to then be able to have time to honor your story. And that's where the mind management comes in.
That's the
work that has to be done. Mm. There is this, obviously, the therapist support, counseling, etc. But you're not with your therapist 24/7, nor is your child. You've got to live with yourself. So what we have to do, and this is where the focus of my work is to help a person to understand how to manage your mind in the moment. What do I do when I wake up at 3 a.m, when I'm at school and someone's bullying me, or when I've had this issue at home and I go to school and I've got to sit and concentrate in the math class, or I'm on the playground and someone's teasing me, or whatever's going on in my life as a child or as an adult? What do I do with, how do I manage my mind in the moment? Because you've got to know how to live with yourself. So the work I do is helping a person to understand how they're showing up and how to manage that. And to recognize when you need the support, give you the tools to tell your, to understand, to process, to tell your story, to deconstruct, to reconstruct, to reconceptualize, reconstruct and reconceptualize. And in that process, to recognize the support that you need, whether it's from a parent, whether it's from a sibling, whether it's from a teacher, whether it's from a parent recognizing my child needs some extra support like therapy or coaching or counseling. Maybe as a parent, for you to cope with a child who's gone through stuff. Maybe you need, what do you need? Because, you know, there's a question I was asked recently, and that is, if you had to, what is the first thing that you would do to help with this mental health crisis with children? And you know what my answer is to that, and what it was to that? Help the parents. Because if the parents know how to help themselves, yeah, they will model that for their children.
Yes.
It's very traumatic when you watch your child go through stuff and you want to help your child and you're being told a message. The current message, the standard of care is get them to a doctor, get them labeled, get them medicated. And you're told that that's what good parenting is. Meanwhile, and here I'm sharing a different message that, hey, that's what you've been told. So don't feel bad about it. You did what you were told. But actually, that isn't the best way for your child. It's not the best way for you. What's best for you is for you to understand why are you showing up like that? How can I then rewire? The great news, Stephanie, is that when we go into that kind of approach, when we recognize that it's okay to make a mess, it's okay to be in this situation because of what I've gone through, the great hope of that is that we can redirect the neuroplasticity of our brain. We can change our brain structure. We can change how our body functions. We'll never get rid of the memory because memory is imprinted forever. But you can change what it looks like. You can take a lot of the power out of it. You can in other words, you don't just disrupt and replace. or eliminate. You can't do that. What we have to do is we have to face, accept, deconstruct, and reconstruct in a way that gives you a sense of peace. And that's what resilience is. And that's something you can teach a two-year-old to do. My youngest
so beautiful.
Two-year-old. Yeah, it's something I should teach you. And that's this particular book. The reason I wrote this is because for years I worked in my practice. I worked with all age groups. And I would help parents help themselves, I'd help parents help their kids. I have four of my own kids. They're all adults now. We've got our first grandchild coming in August. Thousands of, which we're really excited about, thousands of people. We reach millions through our platform, and I decided it's time to actually write a book to help parents help themselves, to help their children, and to teach children these tools. If you can give the child, a two-year-old, the tools, can you imagine what that child's going to be like when they do face the issues that are going to happen as they go through their life, into through their school career, into adolescence, into adulthood? It's inevitable. But if we can have the tools of mind management, which brings us full circle right back to the beginning. Why do we have this? Why is there such a crisis? And my answer initially was that, and I was explaining how the crisis has come not from the fact that suddenly we've got this weird reason that there's suddenly more people with mental health issues. It's not that there's just this thing that just dropped out of life and it's suddenly now we've got this crisis. There's a reason. There's always a reason for the crisis because mental health has always been around. The reason is that if you stop looking at a person's mind and you take mind management out of the equation and you just try and medicalize misery, as I said, or pathologize childhood, you will land up with a worse mental health crisis. And then things like social media will be mismanaged and will add to the problem. Things like COVID, the pandemic, will be mismanaged and will add to the problem. The inevitable challenges of life, the inevitable technological advances, AI is the next major thing that we're dealing with. If we don't teach ourselves to manage our mind, we can't deal with any change effectively. And that's what I believe we need to do. We need to teach our kids from young how to manage the changes in the environment and their world, as well as the changes in themselves and the challenges out there.
So well said. And I think, you know, there's a saying that's coming up as you're speaking, you know, things in life don't get easier, you just get better. And I think that's sort of what your whole arc is here, in that things are going to happen. A girl's going to break up with you, or a guy's going to break up with you. They're going to break your heart. There's going to be tragedy. You're going to lose someone, a pet, a person. You're going to get a bad grade. You're not going to get into the school you want. You know, all the trials and tribulations of, you know, being a young child into adolescence and a young individual, but being able to have some of these skills. And I love what you're saying about the parents doing the work first. I'm sure you are well, you know very well Dr. Shefali Sabari. She's a friend of mine, and very much very similar message. When people come to her complaining about, oh, my kid is like this and like that, and she's like, all right, I don't want to talk to the kid. I want to talk to you, right? So if we can make sure that the parents have some of these skills first, as you so beautifully said, you're going to be able to model that for your children. And gosh, what an unfair advantage for a three-year-old to be able to go through the neurocycle, which we're going to get into in just a moment, to be able to sort of evaluate how they're feeling and then rewrite the story and then effectively metabolize. You know, you said the story is not going to have as much power over you. Effectively, you're going to essentially metabolize the power that has. You're going to take the charge or the edge off of it so that we don't have some of these physiological consequences that you're talking about, the cardiometabolic changes and the cortisol and the insulin and all the things that will eventually turn into a physical or a physiological problem, or, you know, seeing physiological derangement in a way.
I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, It's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount, that is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
Okay. So maybe let's get a little nerdy. As we're diving into the neurocycle, you talked about this in your first book, in your second book as well, some of the different brain waves, that are impacted by the neurocycle. So let's kind of start with some of the, you know, the deltas, the thetas, what happens there. And then we can start moving into, the pieces of the neurocycle. So each of the steps and what they mean and how those, like that thinking, feeling and choosing and how that's going to now drive, you know, dendritic, brain growth.
Absolutely. Well, I love the fact that we're going to do a little bit of the sciencey stuff, and I'll make it very simple too. And I've got like little props and things. Are you okay with me using some?
I would love you to. Yeah. Oh. So anyone watching on YouTube, this is going to be super, super helpful.
I'll describe it as well for those just listening by audio. So essentially, I am a psychoneurobiologist. So that means I look at the mind-brain-body connection. And I have been doing this for like nearly 38 years, nearly 40 years actually. And we still do clinical trials, and we are constantly writing up scientific papers. We've just had one published just recently. We've got about 5 coming out this year. The point being is that science is very important for us to be able to understand and grow forward in our understanding of everything. So in mental health, that's we have to keep doing that. We can't sit back on our laurels. So as a psychoneurobiologist, what I wanted to try and understand was, how does a thought form? What is a thought? What are memories? What are emotions? What is this thing called life, and how does it become part of us and make us do what we do? And, you know, what is going on? And is there any level of control? And what is the difference between in that process between the mind and the brain and the body and all these confusing things that are often very lumped into psychological words that are almost sometimes sound like psychobabble? So I wanted to try and sort of distinguish that and break that down. So on a scientific side, when someone, like right now, as you're listening to me, you're hearing words, you are seeing images, if you're watching YouTube as well, and that is a lot of electromagnetic light forces and gravitational fields and auditory sound waves, a lot of quantum physics and all kinds of things are happening, and your brain and body are receiving all those, all that physics stuff, for want of a simple word. And it's literally going into your brain through the filter of these little biofields around you. And going into your brain, and your brain is responding and your body's responding. So your brain and body, the aliveness of your brain and body is based on the aliveness of your mind. So your mind is not your brain. Your mind is driving your brain. Your mind is driving your body. Your mind is these gravitational fields and electromagnetic light forces and all these things. And psychologically, that's on a science, on a physics level, psychologically, your mind is your ability to think, feel, and choose in response to life. In other words, your aliveness. If you're dead, nothing's happening. You're alive, you're able to process this conversation. And as you are processing this conversation, you are actually making somewhere between 800,000 and 1,000,000 cells every second. And you're changing, and part of those are changes inside of your brain. You're literally growing my words and images that you're seeing into little tree-like structures in your brain that look like little plants. Okay, I'm gonna get this in the right
place. Nice rosemary plant there.
Yeah, and just to give you an image to use, yeah, a sort of an idea.
Little branches, like just little branches. Yeah,
yeah, so a little branch is like a little tree. So our experiences and just whatever we have, like this conversation, is becoming like a tree-like structure in your brain, growing on the tops of neurons, which are called little branches called dendrites. And those dendrites, like a tree, has 3 parts. It has a root system, branches, and a trunk and branches. So the thoughts that you build of the experiences you're having have that structure. So a thought is the encapsulation of an experience. So this is a discussion we're having about mental health. So you're growing a tree of this discussion, and that tree in this discussion, this tree, you could call this tree, like you have an apple tree or a peach tree or something. This tree is called mental health. Let's say, for example, whatever you title this in your head. So it's about mental health, helping yourself, your children, the crisis in mental health, whatever. But the details of what we're saying are all the branches. the roots and the branches. The root part are my words and Stephanie's words, just so this is for the audience. So in other words, what you are hearing and the discussion we're having, that's going into the root system. And then the unique way that you use your mind, the unique way that you think, feel, and choose is basically growth through the tree trunk and producing the branches. So the branches of the tree are your interpretation of what you are experiencing, which then affects how you feel, affects how your body feels, affects what you say and what you do, and it affects how you look at life. So experience via mind into brain as a thought tree, source being the roots, branches being the interpretation, and that combination also is stored in every cell of your body. You have 37 to 100 trillion cells. Now, in your brain, the experience is stored like a tree with all these branches and roots. In your body, in the cells of your body, it's stored as a change inside that what we call the cytoskeleton. What I'm saying, even if this doesn't make too much sense, is you embody the memory. So the memories, the thought is the main thing.
So it's in your mind, your brain, and your body.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in your mind, it's like a field, like a gravitational field. Like if you think of a podcast, it's got little, you know, the little lines that go up and down. That's an easy way to visualize it. In your brain, it looks like a tree. In your body, it looks like a change in the thing that holds the cell firm. And the sort of the gene part of yourself. Just that's the most basic rule thing. But I want you to understand that what you're experiencing is going to all these different parts. Now, because that is happening, and it's happening as we're talking at very, very fast speeds, your brain is responding. And we can pick up the responses in the brain to what you are experiencing. We can also pick up the responses in your body. So mind is the psycho part. Neuro is the brain part. Biology is this body part. So psychoneurobiology is looking at how our mind, brain, and body respond to life and the impact. So if right now I had, for example, I use QEEG in my research, and that looks at, we put electrodes on a person's head and in a certain placement, and that reads that basically is telling us the electrical response of the brain, how the brain is responding electromagnetically, basically. And we can read it as waves. Waveform. So like, think of the waves of the sea. The further far out to sea, I'm in Miami, I'm actually looking right at the sea at the moment. So far out to sea, these big, huge swells. Then as you come in closer, the swells get a little smaller. And then as you approach the beach, it builds into a wave. The crest forms at the top. It crashes on the beach. You have lots of little waves and it goes and repeats the cycle. That's kind of what's happening in your brain. It's this flow of energy. The biggest waves furthest out are the delta. It's delta waves. And then you get the theta waves that are a bit slower, that are a bit faster. And then as you move further in, you get the alpha waves, which are a little bit faster, each one getting faster. Beta's faster, high beta's the crest of the wave. And then the crashing on the beach and the little waves are gamma, which are the fastest waves. So you have all of those waves performing different functions, working together in different states, etc. And you have, it's unique for each person. There's certain patterns we can identify, but it's very much unique to the person and the context. So, for example, if someone's really upset and they've been teased at school and maybe something happened, they got new glasses or something, and they got teased at school, and then at break time they got called a nerd, and you know, just kind of went on for the day. That experience is very anxiety provoking for a child. It makes them feel terrible. And if we had to put a QEG on, we would see bursts in the crest, the size of the wave that's approaching the beach, that the surfer wants to, you know, surf, it'll be bigger. And the crest.
So the conscious waves, like the alpha, the beta, and the gamma are going to be larger in that?
No, not the alpha. So the beta, the beta and the high beta. So the beta is the wave. Mm-hmm. The high beta is the white crest.
The crest.
And the crashing on the beach and the little waves. And the impact that makes, that's the gamma wave. Those are going to increase and the others are going to decrease, something like that. So you're going to have a pattern. Now, but we can't then say, oh, okay, if you have an increase in those, that means you're anxious. Because we also see that exact same pattern when someone's really excited. So like now, let's say that you are you know, you're writing, you learned something new at school, you did really well in a test, or you're having this really great discussion where you say, oh, that's what it means, or you're having a great time with a friend, and, you know, you give it, children having free play, for example, which is so important, and they are unstructured free play, unsupervised by adults, and they're out there and exploring and experimenting and resolving problems. We're going to see lots of high beta and gamma because they're in a state of learning. And so we therefore can't take a waveform and say, oh, that's a bad one, that's a good one. If we see it happening for long periods of time, so now this is, think of a wave. A wave builds, crashes, and then it gets sucked back in, and then it repeats. It's a constant cycle. We don't just have a big high wave. If we do, we have a tsunami, and we have a problem, and we have destruction. So what we want is to have the cyclic nature of the waves. So we want them to build, and then they're going to crash and build, and then, you know, it's this whole cycle going on. You don't want the constant big wave, and then it, you know, builds and builds and builds, and it crashes in your life. So there's this balance that we want to achieve. If the balance is happening, then that helps the rest of the body, the hormones and the heart and the immune system and those kind of things will be balanced as well. So we can deal with an acute situation, like, for example, if you tease once or twice about wearing the glasses. But if it consists and it persists and it carries over into other areas and it doesn't get under control, and you're also the new kid at school and whatever, and it just goes on and on, if it's chronic, then it's like that wave is building and building, then it's moving into a dangerous state. And then so it can tip us in the wrong direction. When we see that happening, then we've got to always look at then what's happening in the body. What are the other example, what's happening in the psychoneurobiology? Yeah. So if you see that someone's really upset and they're crying and they're withdrawing and they're not eating and they're throwing tantrums and they're kicking their sibling and there's a pattern of not sleeping and there's a pattern building, then if we had to look at that person's, that child's brain, we would probably see a lot of high beta and maybe not enough cycles and that kind of thing. And maybe even a little bit of a flat line, like when the sea's very calm for too long. So if anything goes on for too long, then it's problematic. Now, never want to just look at the brain. You always want to say, how's the child showing up? So let's talk about their emotions. Let's talk about how their body feels. Let's talk about what are they saying and doing, their behaviors. And let's talk about their perspectives. Four categories of signals. We want to look at that, how they're showing up. We want to find their story. And then we can see, oh, okay, there's a whole thing going on here that's negative. So that makes sense that the brain is in this kind of almost what we call tonic state of the wrong, too much of the, too long, the waves maybe a bit bigger than they should be and a bit going on for a bit too long. Then we can also look inside the body and see, okay, what's happened to things like cortisol and homocysteine and prolactin and things like telomeres. In other words, we can look at biological things to see if a person is calm and dealing with the issue. And even if they're crying, but they're dealing with the issue, they're facing their stuff, they're not suppressing it. We'll see the body will tell us the story as well. So the body will the things like cortisol will be at the right levels, and homocysteine, which is very linked to inflammation, very linked to how we're managing our emotions, as is cortisol, as is something like prolactin, as are telomeres, which are the ends of chromosomes. Those are all very linked to how we are managing our emotions. On their own, they don't mean anything, but in the whole pattern, if you look at the brain, if you look at it with a story, if you look at it, you know, that if you put it all together, you can build a picture.
And I would imagine you would see behavioral changes too, like sleep is going to be, and you can measure sleep certainly. So you can look at how much deep rest is this individual getting? Are they able to fall asleep and maintain the sleep? Are they, you know, and are they having nightmares and waking, like all of these sort of different behavioral cues as well?
Yes. So it's four categories. Behavioral is one of them. So there's four categories of signals that you'd look at. You ask yourself the question, how is my child showing up? Well, how am I showing up as a parent, as a person, as a human? What are my emotions? What are my behaviors? In other words, what am I saying? What am I doing? How am I sleeping? All that stuff. What is my body going through? How am I feeling physically? And then also, what is my perspective on life? So it could be depressed for anxiety and for emotions, or bodily sensation. It could be a lot of gut issues. For behaviors, it could be maybe withdrawing or tantrums. I'm just making something up. And maybe perspective could be something like, you know, life sucks, I hate school, I don't want to go to school, something like that. I'm just making it very simple. But what we need to do is take those as signals, as information, not as diseases or symptoms of a disease. You don't take those and list those and stick a label on and assume it's part, its neurobiological cause is chemical imbalance or damage to the genes or damage to the brain that's causing that. That's not the cause. The brain will change, but that's the impact, the result. The cause is in what is going on in that life. So those four signals can be, you can imagine that they're four balloons, and that imagine four balloons on strings, and four balloons, when you pull up, when you actually pull the balloons up, you can see they're attached to a tree. Okay, so track with my visual. So look at it like this. So if I say, how are you feeling? Okay, so that's the first balloon. What does that feel like in your body? Second balloon. So that's the behave, that's the bodily sensation signal. Mm-hmm. First one, emotional signal. Third one is, what is it making you do and how are you doing it? Sleep, talking, whatever. Fourth one is, how are you looking at life perspective? Now, as you identify those balloons, you're pulling up what they're attached to, and they're attached to a thought tree.
The roots. That's
tree.
You're pulling up the roots.
It's the whole tree.
Oh, whole tree. Okay.
Conscious, the full tree. So what happens is that when we consciously and deliberately and intentionally gather awareness of these four signals, we start pulling the tree that they're attached to into our conscious mind from the non-conscious. That tree is that experience that the person's had in that root branch tree, you know, the branch and root tree trunk branch format. And so essentially all the roots and the branches being the memories, the details. Memories are details inside a thought. A thought's not the same as a memory. A thought's the thing, the experience made of root memories, made of processing memories, made of branch memories. Okay. So the four balloons pull up the thought, and that's got the detail. Now we need to look at that thought. The first part that we're going to see are the branches with the leaves. So we're going to, and that's going to tell us more details about the emotions, the behaviors. And that's like your question. How are you sleeping? Okay. This poor sleep. What is it? What are the details of the poor sleep? That's what you're going to see in the next level. So once you've pulled it up, you've gathered awareness of it. Now you're going to reflect on, okay, what are the details of the sleep? How often is it an issue? What else, other behaviors? What are other emotions? How, when you feel that emotion, is there always going to be that gut reaction? Is there always, I've got a sore tummy, mommy, every time they're in that particular situation? Is it a migraine? Maybe a migraine, however you say, different people say it differently. So you're going to look at those bodily signals. You're going to look at the four signals in a bit more depth. Then you're going to gather that, put that information and write it down. It's really important that you write stuff down. Now, I'm taking this from the angle of you being the parent observing your child, okay? I'm giving you this example. And what we're busy doing at the moment, for those of you that haven't already realized, and Stephanie, you probably realize this too, I'm busy working through a neurocycle.
Yes, okay? Yeah.
Thing is, you've gathered awareness of your signals, then that's brought up the tree. Now you're looking at the branches, which is the detail of those signals and how it's showing up in your life and the self-talk and how it's showing up in relationships and in schoolwork and in relationships with siblings and just living. How is it, you know, showing up? And then you're going to write that down. When we write things down, and I'm not asking you to write nice, neat essays, I'm asking you to literally throw it on the page. And there's a huge reason why you just write all over the place. Preferably don't even write on lines. Write across the lines. Write something there, whatever pops into your mind from doing those first two steps. The more creative you are with that writing, the more you just follow your gut instinct. What that means is that you are connecting your non-conscious and your conscious mind, and you're getting deep insight, and you're going to pull up the tree even higher, and you're going to start seeing the roots. So we have to dig through the tree trunk to the roots, and the writing helps take you down to that level. Then you're going to look at what you've written, and I'll give you all the timing of this in a moment. Let's just get sort of the process. Then you're going to look at what you've written down. And there's going to be a lot more that you write in this way than what you actually gathered and reflected on. Remember, the first step was to gather awareness of the four signals. The second one was to reflect on more detail around those signals. When you write this down, you're going to have all that, but you're going to have more. You're going to start seeing connections and things that you didn't see before. You're going to start seeing a little, you know, pattern. So the fourth step is to look at what you've written and to start seeing, you know, this has happened. What can I do about it? But before you get to that part of the recheck, you actually want to look at, you know, what have I written here? Can I see connections? Oh, wow, I didn't even think of making that connection. And, you know, so the writing starts creating, bringing out the recheck starts looking at that writing, and you're still kind of writing. This is when I recommend you take another color, for example, and you start drawing circles and links and arrows and look for patterns and antidotes and triggers and the who, what, when, where, why, how. And then you kind of ask yourself a guiding question at this point of, this has happened, now what can we do? Up to this point, for these four steps, what you've done is you have consciously and deliberately and intentionally, in a very intelligent, deliberate way, you have started identifying, looking at who you are or how you are showing up. Let's take for you as a parent yourself first, and then we can take it your child. And you started now deconstructing to the branches, to the tree trunk, to the roots, and reconstructing, because you're starting to see, oh, okay, I'm doing that because of this. See, how we show up with our four signals isn't who you are. It isn't, if it's like a problematic behavior, okay, if it's a healthy behavior, then that is who you are. I'm talking about now the deconstructing of toxic issues. And we can touch on the other side of the positive side in a moment. Yeah. What you're doing is you are looking, how you show up is not who you are. That is, you showing up like that because of something. So this process is saying, very sequentially, going through to the point where you can start seeing the roots. If you skip a step, and I've done the research for years and I'm still doing the research, if you jump straight to journaling without specifically trying gathering awareness of all four signals, if you just gather awareness of your emotions and you jump to writing down your emotions, you will not get the same benefit. Your brain-mind connection is very sequenced, very ordered. And to get your mind management under control, to drive neuroplasticity, to drive the changes that you want, which is to learn to cope with the situation and to be able to increase your resilience and to manage your mental health, which doesn't mean eliminate. It means, how am I going to live with this? How am I going to take the energy out of this toxic thing so that I don't get so depressed that I can't function? That depression can shift back to the normal part, because depression and anxiety are actually very good things for you. They're not bad. There are no bad emotions. Every emotion is information. It's an informational signal. It becomes disruptive when it, like the wave example, when it starts getting too big because it's unmanaged, and then it starts getting like a big tsunami. Then it shifts out of the working for you into working against you mode. So the neurocycle helps you to recognize, hey, this is a tsunami depression emotional signal. I need to rebalance it and get it back to where it actually works for me, because depression and anxiety are actually very, very good for you. They enable you to be all of who you are in your humanity. Our children and adults, we should not be scared of things like depression and anxiety. We should look at them for what they can tell us and get them back into that balance. So this neurocycle very specifically helps to restore that balance in the brain. And we see that. We see that with the psychoneurobiological research. We see the things rebalancing. For example, if someone's in a state where the anxiety and depression have thrown them off the curve and they're out of now, think of a scale. A scale's got a thing in the middle and it's got two plates on the side. And what we want is, in the middle, we've got all our emotions and four signals, behaviors, bodily sensations, and our perspective. Yeah. And then here, these are the two scales of life. So what happens is, if there isn't balance there, then it's going to start tipping. There's going to be more weights on the one side than the other. And then as soon as we get an imbalance, that's when we start feeling mental health challenges. And the more imbalanced, the more mental health challenges we feel. You stick a label on that and you diagnose that and tell persons they're broken, you're just going to make them worse. Whereas if we say, okay, no, that's not who you are, but you have a valid reason for feeling like the balance is skipped in that direction. That's a really hard thing you're going through. It's not nice to be teased at school when you're the new kid on the block. It's not nice to go see your parents constantly fighting because they are going through a divorce and you get stuck in the middle and your parents are crossing boundaries and telling you too much. And this is too much for you. Of course, it's going to make that. But how can we get you to the point where we can get a balance so that you can then have the strength to know how to deal with that? And that's what the very specific steps of the neurocycle are, getting you to get that balance. So it's not taking anything away. It's just bringing the balance back. When the balance is back, then the toxic side of it, this toxic nature will then have that energy transferred to the healthy to keep the balance. Energy is never lost. Energy is only ever transferred. When a child throws a tantrum, or a child comes home from school and they withdraw to their room and they don't want to talk to you, or if a child having sleeping issues and they've got nightmares, if a child, any, an adult as well, those are basically warning signals that there's been a tipping of the scales in the wrong direction. And what we have to do is that energy is that what you're seeing is the energy trying to be processed. The child's trying to process. So when a child throws a tantrum or a child kicks something or throws something, they're not trying to be naughty. They are trying to tell you something. It's energy that they don't know what to do with. So if you don't help them understand that process, then they will keep throwing things and then it does become a problem. And then it does look like they're naughty because they're going to get negative reinforcement. And there's this whole misunderstanding. But if we can help a child, hey, listen, I see you want to throw something. I know that that's a lot of bad things have happened. Something's happened that's made you want to throw something. So let's take that energy and let's, and you can say this. I give all the wording in the book of how you can say this to a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old. I go through all the developmental stages, how you can take that and help a child to transfer that energy. What I've also done, Stephanie, is we created a little toy called Brainy. I don't know if you can see it here. It's a little.
Yeah.
That, and we have a that Brainy is a character that's a superhero that walks your mental health journey. Children that are young, even adults love this toy. But children love to be able to have some kind of point of contact. So Brainy walks your mental health journey. Brainy, you give a child the ability to say, hey, listen, Brainy walks the journey with you. You can help Brainy fix his brain. So Brainy, when you feel sad, and you pick up Brainy, if a 2-year-old doesn't know how to express, which they don't have the words that an adult has, but if they pick up Brainy and bring it to you, it's a point of contact. It's where you as a parent can actually realize, okay, my child wants to tell me something. What you can also do is create an area in your house. Think of it like this. When we clean our teeth, we do it in the bathroom. When you cook dinner, you cook it, you cook it in the kitchen. When you go to the gym, you do a workout. When you play with a ball, you go outside, hopefully, and throw the ball around and you don't break all the furniture. In other words, we understand the designation of place for certain activities. We need to do the same with teaching our children about mind and even ourselves. So if you designate an area in your house, that's an area that you can teach this concept and that becomes a safe space where a child can always go and sit and no matter, there's no judgment, there's no invalidation, there's no matter what you say, that's where you come to process in that safe space. You're going to start teaching the child how to then generalize that to the situation. Like when you're traveling on holiday in the car, you don't have your safe, you don't have your house with you, but in your mind, they know that concept. So what you can do is things like paint a section of your kitchen if you have maybe, or a section of your house or playroom with that chalk paint, and you can have chalk
we
there.
We put tents in there, like a little tent with a little heavy blanket in there. And so they would go there when they were upset and they go under the heavy blanket and then I would crawl into the tent and then we'd talk.
Perfect. That's the concept. Yeah. Sister in law had a wall painted with chalk, and I've had a lot of my patients have done that too. Mm. And there's a box of toys and there's a nice chair or there's a little tent or it's a space that you know that when you go there, that's where you can connect. And if there's the chalkboard, the reason for that is that then the kids could draw pictures, even if it's squiggles. If it's the more literate they are, the more words they'll write. Have paper as well, have journals that you can have there as well, that you can date things. So there's a pattern of things happening. You can date and then you can track for the child how they're going through the process. It's also a way for you, if you have your own journal, you can gather notes if you're working with a therapist. You can actually then, you've got this insight that you can then give to. So there's so many, I mean, I've got hundreds of ideas in the book of how you can apply and adapt this to a child.
And so in the book too, I'll also say that you do a really great job of charts and age-appropriate prompts, which yes. I think, what are some of the more appropriate questions that you might ask a 3-year-old versus a 7-year-old versus a 12-year-old. So there, I really like that laid out because, as a mom who has now a 12 and a 10-year-old, some of the 3-year-old strategies would have worked for them, 7, 8, 9 years ago. But now I also have the appropriate questioning and prompts and ways to talk to my 12-year-old, let's say, or my 10-year-old, which is really useful too. Yeah.
What we've also found is a lot of the, parents, the thing with this is to use this for yourself, as I said in the beginning, as well as for your child. The parents found that just the analogies and things very easy to understand the neurocycle for yourself. So what's really great is the languaging that's there. You can adapt up as you've got a 10-year-old. As I say 3 to 10, but you can adapt the languaging up. And the book that you interviewed me about last time is great for adolescents. But even adolescents, we're finding them, because we've done our beta testing on the book, they, adolescents and parents are even going and saying, okay, I like both because the one is so simple, I can understand the principles and apply it. But you also know your child, so you can use the appropriate languaging. You just sometimes, all we sometimes need as a parent is a prompt, an example of how you could say it. Then you can adapt that down to your child. So that's what I've tried to provide, as you said, Stephanie, with the tables and that kind of thing for children.
Yeah. And I love the even just as an adult, you know, the four categories of signals, you know, and maybe I'm just a late learner, but learning that when I get upset, my throat starts to feel a little achy. Like I start to feel tension in my throat, but being able to recognize that is such a superpower for a 5 or a 10 or a 15 year old. Like I learned it in my 30s, you know, late 30s, early 40s, right? But what an unfair advantage for a kid to be able to say, yeah, I sort of feel like I'm getting some tent, like I get some neck pain or a little, you know, wherever it manifests in the body. I think that's such
It's such a great tool, and they understand it so quickly. You know, some of my adult patients, the reason that I emphasize this so much in my work is some of my adult patients said, why didn't someone teach me this when I was a child?
Yeah.
You know, why didn't someone parent me like this? Why wasn't I given those tools? Why did it take 30 and 40 year old therapy intervention or something like that to actually understand that that was, you know, and to be able to express that? What we see from the neuroscience as well is that, because you like the nerdy stuff too, is that as soon as you have started labeling, doing all these steps as I've described them, you are getting control over that situation. Sometimes you know, the kids are so good at finding solutions. I find this in therapy constantly, and I get this feedback from parents all the time. When you start walking them through that process, when it comes to that step 4, which is the reconceptualization, where this is what's happened now, what are we going to do? It is amazing what will come out of a 3-year-old's mouth and a 5-year-old's mouth. And it may not be the first day, because it takes time to change, you know, and that's the whole thing I mentioned about the timing earlier on. We don't fix anything quickly. Think of when you go and learn a new sport, or you learn a new musical instrument, or you learn a new subject at school. You don't learn it straight away. We all get that. But when it comes to mind, we all think it's instantaneous. You know, one session of therapy or one neurocycle and you're better. Doesn't work like that. Doesn't take 21 days to build a habit either. That's not correct science at all. It takes very deliberate and intentional mindful work for 5 to 15 minutes a day over cycles of 63 days, around 63, 66 days. So you might be thinking, oh my goodness, how am I going to find the time to do this? It's a lifestyle. If you see a pattern in your child that's consistent and persistent, that means it's a pretty established issue that's going on, or combination of issues. And you're definitely not going to fix that straight away. So therefore, turn this into a lifestyle. That's why it's great to have the little tent like you described, or the area in your house that you can allocate, and that you can start talking about those patterns and say, you know, let's talk about these things. So it starts with yourself. As I said in the beginning, let's focus on the parent. If, let's say you get home from work and you've had a bad day, and you walk in the front door and you trip over the kids' toys and they all got the music's blaring, or they've got a whole, their older kids, they've got their friends there and they're running around screaming and there's this huge mess and mess in the kitchen, and you've just had that awful day, and you know that whatever's been going on, maybe your husband was watching them, or you're the husband and your wife is watching them, or you're the husband and husband, whatever the combination is, you maybe shout, freak out, get mad, I can't do this, I've had a hard day at work, you know what, this happens, it's a reality. And then your children like, oh, what have I done? And it can become a real nightmare. What you can do is, you know, this yelling happens, whatever, you can then do a neurocycle and say, oh gosh, I'm sorry, I did not mean to yell. I said, but you know, I yelled emotions. I'm very frustrated walking in and falling over these toys. I'm really tired. I yelled, yes. And my whole body's tense. And that's why I'm like looking at you, like, you know, coming at you like this maybe. And my perspective is, oh no, I cannot deal with this now. This is just too much. So you say that to the kids, and you can do that in a minute. And then you can say, you can be reflecting. You know what, I had a terrible day at work. It was no justification to yell at you like that and, you know, say ugly things like I did. I'm truly sorry. This is, you know, so you reflect. And then you could go maybe sit in that little area, sit on the couch or whatever, or draw something on the board and on your little board, or pull out a piece of paper and do some sort of a writing thing, draw a picture or whatever, pick up Brainy. Anything. That third step is some kind of genetic action. When I say genetic action, your genes are always operating. They're always making proteins, and those proteins encapsulate the information. So when you write, act, visualize, draw, all that kind of stuff, you are directing what you're building inside your brain and your body. So you're guiding what's going to come out next. And it also is giving you more insight. And in you modeling for them, you're teaching them that it's, oh, mom can also have bad days. She's not a bad person. If I have a bad day, I'm not a bad person, and so on. But if you're going to fix this stuff over time, if there's a consistent pattern, you're going to have to do, you know, a lot of work. You're going to have to do the neurocycle for anything from 3 to 5 minutes to 15 minutes, maximum 40 minutes. I wouldn't even do that long with a child. And there's a whole chapter on the timing, but you're going to have to do it almost every day over a period of time. The first few weeks are the most difficult because that's where you get into the root of the issue. And at the end of a certain period of time, we'll have the habit. When a habit is built, that means that I can be in a similar situation. I can be triggered. But I can remember and maybe have a burst of emotional reaction, but I know what to do. I've got my resilience. I've got a plan in place. And if something comes at me that's new, I know how to deal with it. I've built levels of resilience.
When my kids were younger and I would have an outburst, let's say like that, I love that you said apologize to your kids. I think that that is so important if you have done wrong by them, to show them that you are human. And yes, you make mistakes. You are not infallible. So I would apologize then and say, sorry, mommy had a terrible day. Such and such happened. You absolutely are not someone who deserves to be yelled at. And I apologize. And what I would ask for, and this, I don't know where this cat, I'm just as a point of interest, I'm asking where maybe this fits in the neurocycle. I would say to them, can we do a redo? Can we have a redo? And then I would like fake rewind myself. So I'd like walk backwards and then, you know, I'd make little funny voices and then I would like walk in the door again and be like, hey guys. And then we would just have this like little, and then we'd sort of play the thing again. So, and then, you know, I would maybe have a chance to, you know, redeem myself the second time around. And my kids did that too. So when my kids were, you know, they were cranky or they were, you know, one boy's hitting the other boy or, you know, whatever's happening.
Yeah.
And we would have a little debrief about it afterwards, like, hey, what was happening? Why are you feeling this way? What's going on for you? There was one point where I was like, oh, I feel like this is such a good like parent moment because my son, he must have been like 5 or 6 at the time. He's like, mommy, can we have a redo? Can we like redo the whole thing? So like I made a big deal about everyone like going and rewind and making funny noises and then like trying it again. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know where that is. That active? Would you say that that's active reach? Is that something?
Yeah, definitely. That redo definitely would be the active reach. But the whole thing of you actually sitting down and, you know, acknowledging that whatever, that would be your gather awareness. And then that sort of being wise, the reflect, you may not have written it down, but you may have dramatized something. Most people don't realize that that sequence is there, but you would have done something similar along those lines of maybe enactment. And then, you know, what could have been done better? And then your action, let's redo the rewind thing. So, you know, neurocycling is how we as humans, I've just put the name to it. I've done the science behind it and I've made it a very a conscious and deliberate system that we can actually learn to use more consistently. Because what is happening a lot, and Stephanie, you're probably aware of this as well in the schools, because your kids have probably been exposed to this. There's a lot going on about, let's talk about our feelings. And there's a lot of books. If you go and look at the books out there, there's a lot of talking about our feelings. But the problem is if you just talk about your feelings, you're going to bring stuff up. You can't just be mindful. You can't just meditate, breathe, bring it up. Meditation, breathing, mindfulness, all these things are extremely important, but those just prepare the brain. So you have brain preparation, but you have to go beyond mindfulness. You have to go beyond brain preparation into the neurocycle. So you'll see in the book, I talk about brain preparation, which are things like breathing, decompression, you know, getting yourself your neurophysiology under control, that kind of stuff, and then moving into the neurocycle. I'll give you very simple ways of applying it. But that is extremely important in the grand scheme of things that we balance the preparation of our brain. If we're just mindful, it's like a plane flying. All the preparation's done. The engineer comes in. There's a checklist. There's a co-pilot ticking off things. There's a lot of preparation. Then they fly. They take off. If the pilot and the engineers and so on didn't do the pre-checklist, the chances of the plane not working that well, the neurophysiology could be a potential issue. If the pilot didn't know how to fly the plane, what would happen? The plane would crash. So this is, it's a simple analogy, but we've got to know how to prepare the plane, taking off is labeling your emotions and that, but then you've also got to fly the plane, which means you also have to look at where's that emotion in my body? Where's the behavior linked to the emotion? What's the perspective? Why? And going through the step, that's flying the plane. The active reach is landing the plane. Let's land the plane. That's enough work for today. So that's kind of like a little way of picturing it.
Where does daydreaming come in? So you were talking about prep for the brain. Sometimes I'll catch myself, and this is just me as an adult, and I have this conversation with my 12-year-old a little bit more now, where I'll catch myself thinking about something in a in a way that I shouldn't be thinking about it. And I'm like, oh, where'd that thought come from? Is that prep for the brain? Is that in the awareness? Where does that sort of fall in the neurocycle, if at all?
Well, that basically the neurocycle is the system of how you'd actually do something with that. So the fact that you're aware of it is the first part of the neurocycle. So gathering awareness. Oh,
awareness. Yeah.
So you basically were, what was happening there is that you would daydreaming allows us to reactivate parts of our brain called the default mode network. And it's actually excellent for developing creativity and that kind of thing. So daydreaming is actually very good for us. Mind wandering, daydreaming. And I recommend to take at least a 10-minute block in a day where you just deliberately daydream. But daydreaming happens all the time. So intrusive thoughts are often the result of a daydream. And intrusive thoughts are your new best friend. So basically, when you daydream, it's a way of your non-conscious communicating with your conscious, telling you about things that you need to focus on. And the thought that comes up when you think, where did this come from? That's when you can do a neurocycle to go deeper and find, okay, what is this? What is this thought? Where is it actually coming from? To find the source, because it's a message. Daydreaming helps us to be creative and to find the message of, you know, what's disturbing us or what needs attention or something like that.
And you had mentioned before, and I wanted to come back to it, the benefit of free play. So this recording is going to be, we're releasing this at the time of your book release in August, where at least children in the United States are getting ready to go back to school. And then, you know, I'm in Canada, so we start in September, but it can be that August, September, October, November time is often very structured, right? So we have like school, and then we have after school Mandarin classes and guitar lessons and soccer and da 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 da. So what can you speak a little bit more about the benefits of free play? And then, you know, we were talking a little bit about some of the waves, you know, the different brain waves. What are we trying to garner with more free play versus structure play? What is the benefit to the child in terms of learning and in terms of brain development?
It's so important that structure, unstructured play is more important than the structure that a child is exposed to. So it should be a priority in a child's life. There should be more unstructured and free time than structured time. And that's quite a challenge for in this day and age for parents, especially with the demands of school and that kind of thing, going back to school. So that's the ideal. The unstructured play, free play that is unsupervised by an adult is vital in a child learning to actually understand themselves and understand how to cope in life. If we remove that, we are really putting our children in a straitjacket. In terms of brain development, it's massive. In terms of intelligence, creativity, brain development, just physically developing the brain, the psychoneurobiological link, the connection, leading to, you know, wise decision making, more resilience. It has a multitude of benefits in that sense. So it's actually a vital part of a child's life. Our kids should have ideally 3 to 4 hours a day of unstructured play. It's hard to even fit 10 minutes in some of our kids' lives. And that's that we may have to relook at as parents and decide, do I really need your child doesn't need all those lessons. They'll benefit more from less lessons and more free play and spread things out a lot more. And they especially need to wind down after school. If you're going to send for any kind of lessons, if at all possible, do it sort of more early evening, late afternoon versus directly after school. That wind down time is really important, where they can just lie around and do nothing or go in the garden and play with their friends and make up games. And, you know, where you keep an eye on them so it's safe. You don't want them to be in an unsafe environment, but you letting them sort their own arguments out and you letting them work out what to do. So important to unwind and, otherwise, the brain is draining. You're draining like your cell phone, with too many apps open on your cell phone. Think of it like that. That's a great analogy. All the structure is multiple apps open on your cell phone, and your battery's going to die fast. That's what's going to happen to our kids. And if we consistently do that, it does affect creativity. It will they will have mental health challenges. They will feel more depressed. They will feel more anxious. It increases all those kinds of levels. And those are signals telling them they need a rest. They need, and that rest is that unstructured play.
Yeah, and I was listening to your podcast in preparation for our conversation today, and I think you dropped a stat. It was something like the average child in the States, or you can say North America more broadly, has, I think it was 3 to 7 minutes of free time. And then it was 3 to 4 hours of like gaming and structured, you know, after school activities. And I was just blown. I mean, I might have the wrong numbers a little bit wrong there, but
I said around 10 minutes. That's exactly the situation. They're having 3 to 10 minutes a day of unstructured play. The rest of the time is structured.
That's insane.
They're having 12 hours of structure to 16 hours of structure.
And does that include video games as well? Like we include video games in structured play as well.
Sometimes it depends, because if kids get on and they're playing together and there's a whole, you know, if they doing sometimes, you know, they do it through the, they can game with another child in another area of the house or something like that. That is actually pretty creative. So I'm not anti that at all. You just want to make sure they're also getting outside physically. And, you know, I know it's cold, some temperatures are cold, but, you know, dress them up, let them roll in the snow. I mean, these things are, let them build a snowman, let them run with their dogs. You know, these are very important. Let them play with sticks. They don't always need stuff. Let them play with your Tupperwares. Let your babies empty your Tupperware. Let them play with those kinds of things. Let them go build things with sticks in the garden. You know, that is really, really important.
Yeah, I love that you said that, because sometimes my son will get on a FaceTime call with his buddy and then they'll play, I don't know, Minecraft or whatever. But there is some sort of leadership that's taking place. Okay, we're going to go here and then we're going to mine this mine. I don't know Minecraft at all, but it's like, you know, I'm going to go here and then we're going to do this thing over here and then we're going to go to this world and we're going to build this thing. So there is some kind of leadership and creativity happening there. And to your point, yeah, we also want them getting sunshine. Like we want them getting some vitamin D. So I always try to allow some of that, because it's also connection with their friends that maybe they're not in the same school with anymore, and it's fun for them, but it's leadership skills and it's creativity.
That's really great. You don't have to be frightened of those. You know, we don't have to be frightened of anything, like AI and video games. And obviously, when I say don't frighten of anything, there's some terrible games out there. Obviously, we need to use our discretion. But I'm just saying that everything that these kids are going to, they want to do it. We live in a technological age. If you stop them, they're just going to want it more. It's teach them to manage it. Teach them to manage. Don't tell them you can't go on internet. Teach them how to go on internet. Teach them how to play the video games. Teach them about balance. Help them structure that balance in that, okay, you've played 3 hours of video games. How about you and your friend now? Let's go for a walk through the forest, or walk on the beach. I don't know what your environment is, or let's go ride bikes in the neighborhood where it's safe, you know, that kind of thing.
Wonderful. All right. Your new book, tell us where we can find it, the name of it again, and where people can find out more about you.
Absolutely. It's called How to Help Your Child Clean Up Their Mental Mess, A Guide to Building Resilience and Managing Mental Health. Obviously, wherever books are sold, you can find it. And my Instagram handle is Dr. Caroline Leaf. My podcast is How to Clean Up Your Mental Mess. I've got lots of other things. I've got an app called the Neurocycle app, which is really great to guide you through the neurocycle. You've got decompression activities on there and mini neurocycles, and we're adding a parent add-on that should be in before the end of the year. In the meantime, there's a lot of guidance there for anyone to help. That needs
Beautiful.
Help.
And I will just say, I do enjoy the memes that you put on your Instagram. They're very entertaining. Just as I don't know if you're, they're so funny. Yeah, on Fridays, I love them. All right, Dr. Leaf, thank you so much for your time, your focus, your energy, your brilliance today, and all of your research. This is going to be so valuable. Every parent who's listening to this, I think, is going to take some value out of it. And this has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Always enjoy talking to you. Thank you so much.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.